hopefully I'll know what to do next. So first, what I'll do is describe some motivation and the approach I'm going to use, and then describe the model that I'm going to look at from a quantum point of view, and review classical work on this model. The model is very simple. Everybody knows the results from this. It's scalar field collapse and spherical symmetry that was first studied in detail by Matt Chalker. Then I'm going to describe an approach to quantization and how to obtain quantum gravity-corrected equations for that model, and then present some results of a numerical simulation of that collapse with the corrections, and then see what we get. I should say, before going further, that the results I'll present in the numerical simulation are a first set of results on this, and so there are many things that are being refined as we go forward. So, the motivational questions are probably familiar to everyone. We want to ask, what is a quantum black hole? By this, I mean, what is it that forms if you do quantum, if you do gravitational collapse with quantum gravity ideas? What role is played by fundamental discreteness? So any quantum theory of gravity should have some fundamental length scale, and how does it enter into the collapse equations? And lots of questions, how does Hopkins radiation show up in a suitable approximation, if you can actually carry this through and keep evolving? If everything is quantum, the scalar field and the metric degrees of freedom, then everything that we think should show up. And lots of other questions concerning thermodynamics and so on, so the three dots represent that. So one can study these questions in lots of different ways. So essentially, in classical theory, what we have is a metric and some matter degrees of freedom, which I'll collectively denote by phi. And one can ask, okay, given full GR or some other gravity theory or some reduction to a model, how do you want to proceed? So I'll just run through the types of methods that one can potentially use to answer the questions I put out. One of them, which I'll use, is non-perturbative, essentially a background-independent quantization. So we start with some degrees of freedom G phi at the covariant level, then write down the canonical theory, and in some way get a Hamiltonian, and then convert that to an operator and see how far we can get that. And once we have a Hamiltonian, we want to see there's some generic kinds of, or suitable kind of matter geometry state. You want to evolve it and keep evolving it and see what you get after a long time. Another approach is fixed background, where we break the metric up into two pieces and scale the field up into two pieces, all very familiar, which is used in cosmological perturbation theory and also in the semi-classical approximation. Then there are other approaches. For example, string theory-related approach would perhaps use ABS CFT, perhaps not. As far as I know, in these approaches, there are no concrete results for actually black hole formation. So you start off with some matter, which is not a black hole, and follow the evolution through, and see what happens when you get a black hole, whether there is a description in a dual Young-Mills theory of that entire process. So perhaps there is some work there that I don't know about. But then there are other approaches, lots of different ones, which basically postulate that G and phi are not degrees of freedom you should quantize. They're emergent. And so the fundamental degrees of freedom are something else. And we don't know what they are. It could be some collective, G and phi could arise as some collective excitations from some more fundamental kind of a quantum gravity excitation. And the collective excitations could be of various types, some kind of wave function ansatz, which gives low energy behavior. And I don't know if there's any way to study black hole formation using these other ideas yet. So as I said, what we're using is a canonical background-independent approach with the built-in notion of fundamental discreteness to study this problem. So the model is very simple. And it's been around for a long time, the early 70s. Essentially, we take Einstein's equations, the stress energy tensor just to scale the field minimally coupled. We work in spiral symmetry, so there are two functions, f and g, which are functions of r and t. And it's all very familiar. We're 5-0, solutions are flat space of the Schwarzschild metric. The only local degrees of freedom that arise in this theory is due to the scalar field, phi of r and t.
And if you look at the equations, it's kind of a messy 2D field theory, and no quantum theory of this is known. Now, classically, there are no known analytic collapse solutions that are asymptotically flat. There are some which are not asymptotically flat and have pathological behavior and so on. The only solvable collapse models are starting from way back when, 60 years ago, Oppenheimer, Snyder, Vadia, CGHS, and variations. The feature about these models is largely they only have matter inflows, so the black hole always forms. This is a fundamental difference from the scalar field collapse models, where if you start off with some scalar field pulse and let it go, if the scalar field, well, I'm going to come to that, what happens is that inherently in the model there are inflows and outflows. So even if you start off with an ingoing pulse, there'll be parts of it which are outgoing, and so it's not unidirectional. And this is essentially what's responsible for what I'm going to describe next. So in short, the solvable models that we have are very restricted, and the scalar field model, this one, is much, much richer. So essentially our problem is to find the quantum theory of this model. And I'm not going to give you an answer to that question, which is a full answer to the question, but a partial way of asking, can we at least extract some quantum effects from this? So let me summarize what is known about the classical theory. It was shown a long time ago that, in fact, there are two classes of initial data, if I look at the equations in a covariant way. The initial data are just prescribed by phi and the phi dot. So if you start, typically phi dot is taken to be zero, so we just have phi at r t equals zero. The data, there are two types. There's weak data, no black hole forms if there's a long time evolution. The strong data, the black holes form above a certain threshold initial data parameter, and those are initial data parameters that might occur in this function phi of r t equals zero. And so this result here was derived in the 70s by hard analysis looking at this model. So the model is also known as the Christodoulou model because of this. Now, this was all that was there until Chopwick decided to look at the numerical, simulate those equations numerically. To find out what the details are of the transition from weak data to strong data. And later on, I generalized it with some collaborators to include the cosmological constant, both positive and negative. So what are the results of the classical numerical simulations? Essentially, one looks at initial data, which is of the type A squared, some sort of Gaussian with an R squared in front. One can look at different types of data as well. And the scalar field momentum is chosen to be zero. We're now thinking of evolving using an ADM decomposition with some lapse and shift fixed. So that's the matter data. Geometry data is completely determined by the constraints, the Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint. So the way this is done classically is you simply evolve data, and at each time step, you check to see if there's apparent horizon formation. So you compute other observables. One of the observables is just outgoing and ingoing null expansions. And these are, if you like, observables in the fixed time gauge. And they're functions of the data on a slice. And so what you look for is you compute these functions. We know what is a normal expansion, what is marginally trapped expansion, and what is trapped. So normal is outgoing waves are outgoing, and ingoing waves are ingoing. Marginally trapped, outgoing, or that should be zero, the second one. And trapped, so this should be equal to zero. Trapped are both ingoing. And so essentially what one does in a numerical simulation is compute that function and look for its roots and ask how does that root change as the evolution proceeds. That's the simplest way to say how one does this. There's in the simple case where one is in spherical symmetry, this is all one does. But if you're away from spherical symmetry, there are big routines called apparent horizon finders, which implicitly are doing exactly the same thing as this. So we find on each time slice, if there's a solution, if there's a root, that tells us RH of t. That's another observable you can just evolve. And in the long time limit, RH of t is a thing that tells you about the black hole mass. And that radius of the apparent horizon, the long time limit, is a function of all the initial data parameters that you have in your initial data for phi. So the results are essentially that if I'm just using the amplitude here as an example, one could use the width of the pulse or R0 to some extent. If A is bigger than some critical value A star, you get a black hole. And what Choptic found numerically is there's a black hole formula, a mass formula of this type. If A is equal to A star, we have a critical solution, which is a naked singularity. If this is a supercritical region where the black hole forms, and when A is less than A star, no horizon forms. So in the case where no horizon is forming, what happens is a scalar field comes in, it oscillates and slowly leaks out with each oscillation until there's nothing left in the middle except flat space. Gamma is determined numerically, and it's, I'll come to it later. It's some number which depends on the type of matter you're using. It's 0.37 numerically for the scalar field minimally coupled. Okay, so the main lesson from this is classically black holes form without a mass gap. In other words, when A is exactly the critical value, you get the naked singularity, but A is slightly above the critical value, you get black hole of size epsilon, and it just grows. Now, in quantum gravity, we expect fundamental discreteness and singularity avoidance on pretty general grounds. So if you can sneak those things into the evolution equations, we want to ask what happens to all these results if you are able to put in appropriate kinds of corrections to these equations, and is there a nice way to put in the corrections? And I'm not sure what I have to say about the last one, although I suppose I should, given this meeting, but I'll just comment on how the results are modified by quantum effects in the rest of the talk. Okay, so the kind of quantization I'm going to use starts with the ADM variables, and it borrows some sort of discrete background independent quantization ideas from loop quantum gravity, but essentially it's just a familiar Q's and T's and phi's and P-phi's. The action in general is of this form, where N and NA are the Laplace and shift, and H is the Hamiltonian constraint, CA the diffeomorphism constraint. So the basic idea, the overview of how we're going to proceed, is the first step is to see if we can write H and CA as operators on some Hilbert space. And the next thing you want to do is ask if you can find suitable state psi in that Hilbert space, such that you can compute these expectation values, these psi's are not physical states, such that you can compute quantum corrected constraints. The quantum corrected constraints are essentially computing these expectation values. If the states are suitable, if a state psi is peaked at phase space points pq, phi, p, phi, and some length scale L, which is some spreads associated with the state, so L comes from the state, we want to see if there are states which give this kind of, give the classical constraint back, and some corrections, which are these are functions of the phase-based variables as well. No, I'm not imposing the constraints. I'm finding corrections to the constraints. Now, so essentially here the idea is similar to here H is actually the Hamiltonian. And so quantum mechanically, we know that if the classical Hamiltonian becomes an operator, then even for things like the harmonic oscillator, you take a state, compute its expectation value, you'll get corrections of order H bar. Okay. So essentially, the kind of states we're looking at are semi-classical states, which are peaked at phase space points and have a width. And so we expect an expansion of this type. This k here is some power which may depend on the state, and so this is the sort of approach. This has actually been done for semi-classical states for the cosmological case. Okay, so now the basic idea is to get quantum corrected collapse, what we want to do is once we've got this HQG, which is the corrected Hamiltonian constraint and the corrected diffeomorphism constraint, we want to pretend that they're just classical. And now we want to write down Hamilton's equations and get the evolution equations for Q, pi, phi, and p phi, and see what happens. Now, there are two types of corrections that are going to appear in H and C. Yes? Yeah.
So this Hamiltonian is not longer vanish and depends on the state. But
that's right.
But then while you evolve, you're going to leave the state to what it was. So the Hamiltonian is going to be, in your notation, time independent.
No, it's not. I'll come to that. I'll come to that. So the idea here is I want to get modifications to the classical equations of motion.
And the modifications to the classical equations of motion are going to come about when I take the constraints, represent them as operators, take suitable states, which give, and in those states, the expectation value gives the classical constraint plus corrections. Now I'm going to pretend I didn't do all of that, and I've got new constraints, and this is a classical theory. Now I'm going to fix gauge and evolve. I'm just going to come to this. Okay. So first, let me just comment on the types of corrections that are going to arise in these quantum corrected constraints, or if you like, quantum corrected evolution equations. The first thing is, if there's fundamental discreteness, what we expect is that there's going to be no momentum operator because there should be no generator of infinitesimal translations if you have fundamental discreteness. So any momenta that appears in your evolution equations or in the constraints is going to be written indirectly using translation operators. And so what would have been a nice derivative operator is in fact a kind of shift operator which depends on the fundamental discreteness scale, lambda. That's one kind of correction. So in other words, wherever you see momentum conjugate to Q, momentum conjugate to phi, think about this change wherever there's a momentum. If there's a momentum squared, it's going to be the square of this operator. Yes. I'm going to come to the detail in a minute. This is just an overview.
So essentially what's happening is there's a Hilbert space which I haven't
told you about yet. All I'm pointing out is if there's fundamental discreteness, then there's going to be no way to have an infinitesimal generator of translations. And there will be a Hilbert space that I'll talk about later in which you'll see the concrete action. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. You have to think of a lattice in the background. Yes, and the Hilbert space is adapted for a lattice.
But it's a lattice in superspace, not in.
I'll say what it is as soon as I get it. This is the first kind of correction. Another kind of correction is, of course, when you write down matter Hamiltonians, you have 1/q factors. The 1/q factors are inverse functions of the metric. So if your metric has functions, say phi and r and lambda, for example, you'll have factors of 1/r. So in general, if you have any inverse configuration operators, then there's a way of writing inverse configuration operators, if you have fundamental discreteness, using the translation operator and the square roots or other fractional powers of configuration operators. And these are this kind of a way of writing inverse operators arose in loop quantum gravity. So I'll call this a Feynman-like trick. Essentially, the idea is really simple. The idea is if you have some function f of x and you want to take its derivative, what you do is you replace this by something like fn plus 1 minus fn minus 1 over some lattice spacing of all delta x. But now if this function is taken to be root x, then we know that its derivative is going to be proportional to 1/√x. So we square this thing if you want to get 1/x. Now you finite difference this, and out pops this trick. So this trick is actually nothing but a finite, kind of a finite difference approximation that you might put on a lattice. Okay. So written this way, it looks like it's hiding some sophisticated stuff, but this is the meat of what this is. Okay.
I'm going to come to that. Yeah, I'm going to come to all that. Okay. So essentially, all I want to point out here is there are two kinds of corrections we're going to expect. Corrections from writing momentum operators using translations, and anywhere where you see an inverse configuration operator, you're going to write it as something which is a lattice-dependent operator. Okay. So I want to point out what happens if you look in simple models at eigenvalues of this kind of an operator. Suppose you have 1 over x. The kind of correction you get is this is standard classical minus 1 over x, and the dotted line there is what the eigenvalue of that kind of an operator is. So to see what the effect is going to be, you see that at close range, depending on the lattice spacing or the discreteness scale here, this is plotted for lambda equals 0.1, what you get is a kind of repulsion at short distance scales. And again, this is just a consequence of writing inverse configuration operators in that way, equivalently this way. Okay? Yes?
When you take this repulsion, what happens to the energy condition?
What happens to the energy condition?
Reconstruction.
Oh, they can be violated.
So what about rho?
What about?
Rho greater than zero.
Okay, so essentially what we're doing here is simply taking a procedure for constructing quantum theory and proceeding. There's no reason why any classical energy condition should hold. In fact, we're going to get a kind of repulsion anyway, as we'll see, which is ultimately the origin of the mass gap that I'm advertising. So all I want to point out here is if you look at these two kinds of corrections, which are coming from the quantum theory, this does some stuff, this does something else. What the second one does is this kind of stuff. Okay? So let me now go into some details and answer some of the questions that arose. We're in spherical symmetry, so I'm going to start with a spatial metric of this type. It's got two functions in it, lambda and r. And so what we have is the geometry phase space variables are r and its conjugate momentum, and lambda and its conjugate momentum, and then of course you have the scalar field variables as well. Now here's the definition of the basic operators. We have an operator r hat, which is a configuration operator, and it acts on a state a1 to an, which are a bunch of real numbers at some lattice sites, R1 to Rn, which are randomly chosen. Now, this R hat,
if it sees that there's an excitation at location Rk, it gives you that excitation and gives you the state back. Okay? The translation operator comes along, it depends on Rk, it looks at the state. If it sees an Ak, it adds a lambda. If it doesn't see an Ak, it just creates an excitation there of size lambda. Okay? Exactly what a translation operator should do. So you can do similar definitions of the other phase space variables, phi, p phi, r, pr. Think of this just as putting the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on a lattice, if you like. Okay? Just discretize, write down the Wheeler-DeWitt equations, discretize them. So this essentially is a LQG-like representation, except there are no holonomies. The holonomies here are replaced by translation operators. Triads are essentially replaced by the R's, which are diagonal, and the holonomies are shift operators in LQG. So how do we do the numerical simulation? Well, there's a code that I modified, which I'd written earlier with some collaborators, and it's a code written for the classical equations. So we go back to the code, modify certain pieces where the evolution equations acquire these corrections. And what I'm going to show you includes only one type of quantum gravity correction, that which takes wherever there are occurrences of 1 over r. Remember, 1 over r is that thing there. It's a field. And replaces it by the corresponding eigenvalue of that operator. The horizon detection uses exactly the same procedure. In other words, we simply have modified Einstein equations. Everything else stays the same. and the kind of initial data we use is exactly the same as what was used by Chopthwick. This is so that we can see if in the end, when we turn the lattice scaling, the fundamental length scale to zero, we get the classical results back. Okay? So essentially, the only thing that has changed from the classical case is you scan the equations with this kind of procedure in mind, make changes to the right-hand side of Einstein's, right-hand side of Hamilton's equations, the r dot, phi dot, et cetera, and then proceed with this code. Yes?
You're saying only this 1 over r type directions are included? So does that mean you have momentum arbitrary small scales for the scale of the instance?
So what I did is, in order to put the, yes, so there are two corrections. The momenta are replaced by those shift operators. I didn't put that in this evolution. Okay.
But you are replacing the 1 over r by the eigenvalues in the classical dynamical equations, or before you get the evolution equations?
Here, I'm just setting up the evolution equations.
So we have the classical evolution equations, and wherever we see 1 over r, we get
the... Well, that's not how I got the evolution equations. I got the evolution equations by first getting the constraints and then deriving the evolution. So not plugging them into the evolution.
So the evolution equations are the modified...
Absolutely. They're the modified evolution equations. Yeah. This is why I went through this procedure of saying the constraints are modified with these corrections, and now we treat these modified constraints as the bona fide Hamiltonian, which is going to control the classical variables.
So here's a graph of the case where lambda is zero. Lambda is the discreteness scale. And look at what this graph is showing. It's essentially reproducing Chopthwick's results. What we find is the mass of the black hole. This is a log-log plot. So this is log, sorry, the print is so small. This is log of the radius of the apparent horizon found by finding roots of that theta function as the evolution proceeds. And here is log of A minus A star. This graph was produced for A bigger than A star. A star was found numerically by running the code, constantly reducing A until you find that no black hole forms. Okay. So what we find is there's some constant K, and the mass of the black hole is A minus A star. It's actually 0.375 for this particular run. Another thing this is showing was something found later after Chopthwick's first runs, which was that there's actually an oscillation around this line, which was first found by Karsten Gundlach. So the point is, when you take those equations, put lambda equals zero, we get what we should get when there's no discreteness scale. Okay, so now if I go to the case where lambda is not zero, I have a slightly different kind of graph so that they all lie on the same one, and I hope that's visible. So here, this should be lambda, not L. So when lambda is not zero, you can see that mass gaps are evident at the threshold of black hole formation. So what's happening here is this bottom line here is lambda equals zero. This is the classical result, and that's and you can see that it intersects the origin. So black holes form with zero mass. This is not a log-log plot. This is RAH versus A. Okay, and so you can sort of read off A star where this intercept is. Then moving up, The green line is lambda equals 0.15. This line here is 0.15. And then we have, it's 0.05. I'm going down this way. 0.05, 0.1, 0.15, and 0.2. So you see what happens is, firstly, if A star, look at this feature over here, if the amplitude is really large, this means you have a large ADM mass to start with, and you let it go, then there's very little difference in the size of the black hole that forms. So if you've got lots of data, it doesn't see that fine repulsion near the origin that is implicitly creeping in through the way that 1 over r's are written in the quantum theory. So as A gets smaller and smaller, you can see that these things start spreading out. And notice that for the cases where A is large, the black hole is largest. And as A gets small, for the same A, this is the feature, black holes form at larger and larger mass. Then we come to this end, and this area we're still investigating numerically more precisely. But what's happening is that below these values, there's no black hole. So for example, for the case of 0.05, you can read off the mass gap. For this one, you can read off the mass gap. And the mass gap is larger, the larger is the discreteness scale. Okay. So this aspect of the result seems robust, although we haven't finally located the A stars for the lambda not equals zero case. But it's precisely located for the case where lambda is zero. Okay.
Just that till we reach that mass gap, we guarantee that the momentum of R is much smaller than 1 over lambda?
The momentum of R is smaller than much, yes. Yeah. So I mean, the momentum is essentially, I didn't write the momentum in this discretized form.
Yeah, but that's what I'm worried about, because we should make sure of that. Otherwise, like, I'm not very sure. But you're saying that the initial conditions are set like that.
So the initial conditions are set like that, basically.
Well, basically, what I want to ask is that before we reach the mass gap, are we already hitting Planck density or we are below it?
No, you're not hitting. Well, you see, let's look at the size of the mass gap. The size of the mass gaps here, the discreteness scale is here. So you can simply compare the mass gap to the discreteness scale. Okay. So we've got lambdas here, 0.05 and so on. And so here, the mass gap is of the same order as the Planck scale, okay, in each of these cases. The only thing we don't know is what precisely A star is for these three cases, but A star is precisely known for the lambda equal zero case, at least in this simulation. Okay, so let me summarize this before going commenting on one other aspect of spherically symmetric collapse. What I gave you is a procedure for computing quantum gravity corrections to gravitational collapse. This procedure uses a Hamiltonian starting point and writes p's and phi's and so on as operators. There are two kinds of corrections that arise in general. One is that p is written as a difference of translation operators. The other is inverse r factors are written in the way that indicated using this Riemann kind of trick. The simulations I gave you use only one of them. So the feature that's robust in all this is this mass gap. There's a mass gap at the onset of black hole formation. And the critical solution for lambda not equals zero is not a naked singularity. And essentially, these results are quantum gravity corrections to the toxic behavior. Now, I want to comment on this mass gap issue. This also is known in the case of homogeneous Oppenheimer-Snyder model, here of the scalar field and the metric variables just depend on time. And this was found a bit earlier, a couple of years, just 3 years ago, I think. And here, this model exhibits no critical behavior. Now, there's no critical behavior for precisely the reasons that I said earlier. These are pure inflow models. The black hole always forms. In order to get critical behavior, you need inflow and outflow, so you get the critical, you get some critical amplitude below which there's no black hole formation. Now, there's a long to-do list. The first one is put in the d lambda corrections and see what happens if you can continue evolution beyond horizon formation. Our code is not doing that yet, and so it needs to be fixed. In particular, we want to ask if horizons begin to shrink, etc. We want to, in a similar way, we can drive quantum gravity corrected Fine-Dwarf equation. In a sense, it's already included here because this is scalar field coupled to gravity, so there's a Fine-Dwarf equation on the background. So implicitly hiding in there is some modified dispersion relation.
This is very distinct. My question is on the analytic understanding of the formation of the mass gap. This is a dynamical mass. Is this due to the curvature of space-time that starts forming when the black hole is formed? Do we understand? Because, you know, in curved space-times, of course, fields can acquire masses. So is this the same? I mean, what is your analytical understanding?
There is no analytical understanding, even of the Chopra behavior. Well, there is some, but it's nothing that goes beyond the numerics. So here, essentially, we have some equations. We just evolve them and see what's coming up. I don't think there's analytic understanding.
So it's nothing to do with the curvature of space-time that
Well, ultimately it is, because I'm doing Einstein's equation. So there is some connection, but what is the details of this connection, I don't know.
Two questions. So if you're getting a negative pressure, so you're violating the getting around the Hopkins Penrose theory.
Yes.
So
that's why singularity is zero.
If you pile enough negative pressure at the center, then you get a bounce from the collapse. So if you have enough negative pressure, then you may never get a black hole unless you have an infinite amount.
Well, this is this question of, can you continue the evolution to see what happens? So here we're tracking this function r horizon of t, and if the code could be continued, we want to look at this root and see, initially the root is getting larger and larger, and does it get smaller and smaller, and does everything disappear again? So is there a total bounce? And so this is simply a matter of taking these equations and pushing the simulation as far as it can go.
You're putting in exotic matter.
Well, there is no exotic matter here, it's just a scalar field at the moment.
No, but rho is negative.
I think it's the basic point is that the effects of quantum geometry can be written as an effective matter which violates weak energy condition. Nobody's putting it off. He's just taking a scalar field which obeys all energy conditions. But the way dynamical equations show up, one can rewrite them in a form that you have an effective matter which violates energy conditions.
Well, yeah, this is essentially because of that change in the 1 over x line I showed you. That comes about because of the way the operator is written, and the eigenvalue of that operator is different from 1 over x. And so that's really, ultimately, I think, the source of this mass gap.
One more question.
Yes?
When you do Oppenheimer slider, you have to join the surface.
That's right.
To an exterior solution. What do you join it to?
Well, I didn't do that work. You should ask. Now, I want to comment on one other thing, since I'm working in spherical symmetry, before closing up. This is a comment on holography. So in earlier talks, we heard that in LQG, there's a natural way of deriving holography. And so I want to point out what that argument is and where it works and where it doesn't work. So I'm just going to look at it not in LQG, but in the context of this model. So the main point is, here we started off with a spatial metric, which has got two functions in it. And so if I look at the volume, it's just that Q in this gauge lambda equals 1. It looks like that. Now, one of the operators in LQG is the volume operator. Now, normally the volume operator has got has got several factors of the metric. It's got three factors of the metric in it. And each of them in full quantum gravity would be converted into an operator so that any volume operator you get would depend on the cube of the, its eigenvalues would depend on cube of the Planck scale. Now, if you have a model of this type, where you have spherical symmetry or any other kind of reduction, then the volume operator has got less dynamical variables inside it. If it's got less dynamical variables inside it, when you convert the thing into an operator, you're going to get the volume operator depending on r squared instead of r cubed, for example. So what happens is that in this fixed gauge, there's some length scale which absorbs the extra dimension. So the eigenvalues of this kind of an operator, remember we have an R operator, so you have an R squared operator, are proportional to L times LT squared rather than LT cubed had there been no gauge fixing, okay? Where this L is a coordinate length. So what does that do or not do? Now, if you have a fixed coordinate length then, because you have a fixed gauge, then the unit quantum volume is going to be just some number k times LLT squared, because that's the basic unit. And so the number of such units in a sphere, coordinate sphere, are just going to be 4/3 pi L cubed divided by the basic unit, which is KLT cubed. So out pops L squared over LT squared. Now, this is clearly not generic. It can't be.
So essentially what I want to point out is this is the essence of the argument that was made by Gambini and Pullen for holography from LQG. So it's important to note where it applies and where it doesn't. It applies to other cases beyond spherical symmetry, provided the gauge fixing reduces the number of dynamical variables in dead Q. If it does that, you get less factors of LP from the corresponding eigenvalue of the volume operator, and you get more coordinate lengths. And so this is why you're getting L squared for this case. If you kill more degrees of freedom in the metric or start from even a more reduced symmetry ansatz, you could even get L here, and clearly you don't want that. Okay? So the point is that this argument is very restricted, and it applies in spherical symmetry. You can give the wrong answer if the symmetry is even less. Okay? So of course, when they presented this argument, they did it in full LQG, but essentially the key point in that entire argument is that the eigenstates of the volume operator depend on LP squared and not on LP cubed. So whenever you can arrange that, you'll get holography coming out in this way. If you can't arrange it, you're not going to get it. Well, it's not really fine-tuning. What it's saying is that at least in this kind of an approach, we want to ask normally entropy is proportional to volume. So you have a volume operator, and then you ask, well, what do the eigenvalues of the volume operator look like? If the eigenvalues of the volume operator depend on LP cubed, entropy is proportional to LP cubed, you're not going to get holography. If the eigenvalues depend on LP squared, which can be arranged if you do these reductions, then you can claim that you've got holography. But the essence of the argument doesn't really need anything in LQG. It just needs this observation here, that observation, and the fact that one of the metric functions is no longer a dynamical variable. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Okay, are there any questions? Please.
I just have a comment. So actually, it will be very interesting if we can also include the momentum correction.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because you see, it's like if we look 5 years back when Martin Boyer was introducing like 1/a correction, and it was I think like at that time nobody included the momentum corrections. But eventually, when we did the numerical simulations for the universe going towards the Big Bang, by putting the states, we found that this 1/r corrections don't show up much. They show up much later than the momentum corrections show up. And actually, the bounce or the singularity resolution occurs just because of the momentum corrections. So I'm pretty sure that there will be a mass gap even when we include the momentum corrections.
Yes.
But it will be very interesting to compare what happens in the black holes, the gravitational collapse of black holes, and if we can do the similar thing for cosmology. Maybe for black holes, the situation is different. Okay,
yeah. I think it needs to be looked at in this.
If you take Oppenheimer's slider for that, and you put the vacuum energy at the same dark energy, which is supposed to be, and when you read the Oppenheimer's slider, you get a bounce. But the bounce is not due to quantum gravity. So it's not clear that quantum gravity is creating a non-black hole solution. There's another way of doing it. The implication is that you need quantum gravity to get a bounce.
Well,
it's a question.
So I think that this is a question concerning the starting point. So here I'm just saying we know this model classically really well. Let's see what turning on some quantum gravity on this model does. And so just asking that question gives this sort of answer. Of course, you can get that answer in lots of different ways. Like you probably can.
As soon as you violate the strong and weak energy conditions and something in the center, then you're going to get a burst.
It's a matter of how you want to input it. And so here, it's simply, if there's some other way of doing the quantum mechanics of this model that doesn't do that, it would be interesting to see what it is.
How did you get a state 5 that allows you to compute the correction to the constraints?
So I gave a reference where we did that for cosmology. And so here the idea is if you have a set of lattice points. At each lattice point, and you have a scalar field, you have a classical scalar field profile. This is a classical state that you want. This is, let's say, phi rt equals 0. And we want a semi-classical state that's peaked here. So here we've got a lattice. And so this is a field theory. So what I want to do is I want to say, OK, each point is a quantum mechanics system. So I want to have the state of this point be peaked at that value, the state of this point peaked at that value, and it's a product of those states.
When you numerically discretize a derivative operator, you can do this to different orders by using more lattice sites. If you did the corresponding thing with your procedure, would you get a different result?
Okay, so firstly, this is a known ambiguity. And so there's many ways of writing this 1 over r. Each way of writing that 1 over r using the translation operator gives you a different way of discretizing. So we've run the code for just one way. But all of the different ways have the same feature. There's repulsion, short range. And the details of that repulsion are different. At long range, it gives you what you want. Short range, it's different. And so because of repulsion, the mass gap won't change. The details might change. You might have shifting of the gap up and down if you take different different versions of that 1 over r operator, which is the same as finite discretization.
Yeah, two related questions. As far as I understand, you don't discretize your time, you discretize only the r. Is that right?
So what I've done is I have got quantum corrected equations, but now I'm just evolving them as if they were normal differential equations.
Right.
Yes.
Because my question was related to that. Suppose that you had a two-dimensional lattice. So could you, if you had dynamical, like triangulations, you know, these sort of things instead of a fixed lattice scaling, you think your solution would change? Or at the moment, you keep a lattice spacing fixed.
Yes, here it's fixed, yes.
So
if I dynamically vary this, this is like saying you want to do adaptive measure finding.
Yeah.
And if you do adaptive measure finding, the only thing that happens is your answers are much more refined.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not expect the mass gap to go away, because the source of the mass gap is completely different.
Right.
I would expect the details perhaps will change, and probably give me a more accurate answer for the critical amplitudes and the mass gap if I were to do that.
But it wouldn't change the positivity condition?
It would not change.
Wouldn't you, on the basis of the physics of it, expect the discretization itself is dynamic?
If you expect it on, so certainly there's more than one way to implement this. So what you're really asking is, when I write down the translation operator, do I want to put an x dependence in there? And you can put an x dependence in there. You just have to follow it through the code. And you can say, well, I want everything to be refined. In fact, the first Chopik's classical work in detecting A star was done with adaptive measure finding, too. But that was for a different reason. It was done so that you could get A star very accurately. And it was not done for a quantum reason. And that was purely numerics. But now, of course, if you do the same thing, I would expect that you'll just get more refined results. You just get a mass gap determining more precisely. Now, there's this other question of asking the same question about cosmology. Because you can rig up a cosmological model like this and do exactly the same thing without inhomogeneities. You've got phi coupled to eta and A, where you assume that everything depends on T and X. And you've got two functions in the metric. And now you compute some quantum corrections. And now you want to ask another question there, which is you want quantum gravity to tell you that some things are small and some things are not small. And that's a much harder problem than this. So, in fact, there is a cosmological model you can write up like this, but you can't assume a priori that you have a fast degree of freedom and a slow degree of freedom. You have to have A depending, scale factor depending on T and X, and another function depending on T and X, and you want it to dynamically tell you that the chi's become small and the A's become homogeneous or something. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I'm not watching the tops.
Perhaps it's a silly question, but in the classical regime, we know that there is a coherence between the, I don't know what word to use, between the constraint and the evolution equations. I take something that satisfies the constraints, I evolve them, and then they satisfy the constraints.
Yeah,
you change the constraint. You have changed the constraints somehow, and you have changed the evolution equations. Is there such a coherence appearing in your
numerically, I have to impose that, otherwise the answers are not considered. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the corrected Hamiltonian constraint, treating it as if it's a classical constraint. I have to impose it in each time slice and make sure that it's actually imposing the error in it is very little. Otherwise,
so I'm not project in each slice after you evolve the initial thing, you project into the constraint.
So I have to ensure that the evolution is consistent with that. So I actually have to solve numerically the constraints at each time step. And yes, it's a fully constrained classical evolution, but with modified constraints. So I'm not doing it at the quantum mechanical level, because at the quantum mechanical level, I'm simply driving the corrections to the constraints. Now I'm doing, once I've got those, I'm doing everything that classical numerical relativity people do. They have to make sure the constraint is satisfied with each time step. And the other thing I didn't mention is the evolution is with respect to a fixed lapse and shift. So classically, of course, I have to fix time gauge, and I have to fix radial gauge before I do the evolution. But we're still under time, so we can ask.
No, just a quick to understand how complicated numerically these equations are. Like, is it something you can do on your computer? Because when we do the spin from graviton propagator, we need the sharp.
Okay, so I'll tell you this. Every point on this graph took about half an hour on a desktop.
Okay, so
Because essentially what we have is a set of coupled PDEs in two variables, P and R.
We have a year CPU for each dot, so okay.
Yeah, it's not probably as much as spin foam.
Hey, Seth?
Yes, sir.
I wonder if I can characterize this in the following way. So, if I take a constrained system, just you have a spherical symmetry with a scalar field, then compute the expectation value, where the expectation value is really taken in terms of the quantum gravity kinematics. Then generate a new set of effective constraints, and then evolve those.
That's exactly what I'm doing. Yes. I'm saying I've got new classical, well, new constraints, and they have built-in quantum corrections, and we expect that because any operator, when you take an expectation value in a reasonable state, could give you classical stuff plus corrections. It could give you lots of other stuff, but the state is not a good state, or some other state.
Other questions? Thanks again.